We are at the 18th verse of the 10th chapter. And I think one of the things that we keep doing as we read Romans is to reduce what Paul is dealing with here so passionately out of his own experience of Christ to some kind of abstract argument. And I think that is the problem with most of our exegesis of Romans. That is, we do not come face to face with the fact that Paul here is appropriating Christian experience and appropriating Christian experience as a way of understanding himself, as a way of understanding the world, and above all, as a way of standing in the presence of God. And when we forget that, then our exegesis just sort of flattens out and goes nowhere and has no passion and really lacks any significant meaning in terms of what we are and what we do and what we find in the world. So then, with that in mind, let us begin with 10:18. But I ask, have they not heard? And here again, I think Caseman's right that the RSV rendition is not right, where he says, indeed, they have. I think that the Greek would support the translation, certainly not, for their voice, and that really fits in with the argument. Certainly not, for their voice has gone out to all the earth, and their words to the ends of the world. Again, I ask, did Israel not understand? First, Moses says, I will make you jealous of those who are not a nation. With a foolish nation, I will make you angry. Then Isaiah is so bold as to say, I have been found by those who did not seek me. I have shown myself to those who did not ask for me. But of Israel, he says, all day long I have held out my hands to a disobedient and contrary people. Therefore, it is quite clear that they have not heard. Now, what is Paul talking about here? As I tried to point out at the end of the session on Wednesday, what is at stake is the apostolic mission. And the apostolic mission is the mission that has been constituted and empowered in the world by Christ. So the preaching of Christ is not simply talking about Christ, but rather it is the continuation in human history of the reality of the Sovereign Lord in the word of preaching, and specifically here in the word of the apostle to the Gentiles, Paul. He's talking about his own apocalyptic mission, and that is the message of salvation to the Gentiles. Now, it is that same message that has been given to Israel, and Israel has rejected it. Now, Paul is always speaking apocalyptically. I think that there is no way to overemphasize the importance of that in understanding Romans. And one of the values of Baker's book is that he helps us to see that the apocalyptic framework of Paul's gospel is not something that you can sort of slough off, and having sloughed it off, then recover the eternal and timeless message of Paul. Because when you do that, and we have done it, I think that the history of exegesis will support this, when you do that, the gospel is reduced then to the moralizing that seems to be relevant to our situation. And so you begin reading Romans at chapter 12. And when you begin reading Romans at chapter 12, you simply have perverted Paul's gospel into another form of the law. And this is, I think, the thing that Paul has already anticipated in Rome. And that's the reason that he is going to such great lengths to establish the fact that the gospel is the justification of the ungodly. The gospel is the action of God on behalf of those who simply cannot help themselves. And if we can help ourselves, then begin with chapter 12. But Paul says it is quite clear from the experience of the gospel in the world that we cannot help ourselves. Now, to get back to what I started to say about Paul's apostolic mission, which is the fulfillment of the promise that salvation is for all the nations. See, now, Paul also is operating under the traditional Jewish expectation that when the nations are gathered in, then there will be the end of human history. God's work will be complete. Now, one of the things that Paul believes is that he is already participating in the end, and that the end is imminent, that it is to be expected in his lifetime. So he is, when he quotes from the Hebrew Scriptures, their voice has gone out to all the earth, and their words to the ends of the world. He has this breathtaking vision of his own apostolic ministry. That is, when you read about his plan to come to Rome and to go to Spain, that has to do with the final chapter of salvation history. Now, this is the most troublesome thing, as Caseman points out, that we have to grapple with in Paul. It may be the most troublesome thing that we have to grapple with in the New Testament. That is the apparent failure of the apocalyptic vision. Huh? See, what Paul expected to accomplish in the remaining years of his life has not been accomplished in 2,000 years of history. No. And so that really creates the problem of how to appropriate Paul's apocalyptic message for the church today, for the world today, for Christian experience today. And I'm not going to pursue that in any detail, except to commend to you a careful reading of Baker's book, which is one attempt to do that. It is probably not altogether successful. I doubt if any attempt will be altogether successful. But it is an admirable attempt, and it raises the issues that we have to deal with. Let's see. Do you understand? You're sitting here as if I were talking about something that had no relevance to your life at all. Just sort of, when will he get back to the subject? Why is this important?
The whole perspective of the letter, the whole perspective of it's a different worldview. It's real hard to understand that.
May I do something on the blackboard? It's not going to help. But when I don't understand it, you know now that when I write on the blackboard, it's because I don't understand. Huh? Have you caught that? Give you a little clue. When I run out of anything to say, I write on the blackboard. Now, take that as the line that is human history. Okay. Now then, take the old age imagery, and that is the age of trust in one's own righteousness, right? Now, that old age has been invaded by the new age, and that is the situation of the possibility in human history of already living in the time of the end, that is the consummation of God's purpose, so that the new age or the new creation, you see, which comes at the end of history, is already anticipated in Christian experience. Okay? The form that takes is faith in the world. And where faith is present in the world, there is the church, where you have preaching and confession and prayer, there is the new creation. Huh? Already. Now then, it is Paul's understanding that his apostolic mission is preaching to the Gentiles so that the promises that have been made to Israel and that have been rejected by Israel in unfaith will now be appropriated by the Gentiles. And when the Gentile mission is complete, then, and this I think is the kind of chronology that Paul is working with, then there will be the parousia, you see. That will be the coming of the exalted Christ to make complete, visible what is now hidden in the old age, in the presence of faith in the community of the church. Now then, what Paul believed, it seems to me, is that his preaching was God's eschatological act in human history that would bring then the time of the parousia. Do you see that? The only thing that's wrong, it seems, well, that's wrong. One of the things that creates problems for us then is that what Paul thought would be a short time has become a time that goes on and on indefinitely. Now, I think then that what has happened is that the church has turned away from this apocalyptic way of looking at things to an assumption that is quite different. And this is one of the values of Baker's book. The assumption is that history is going on forever. Now, if you want to experience the dramatic difference between the world in which Paul lived as a participant in this apocalyptic vision and the world in which we live, that's precisely it. Our assumption is that our history is going on forever. There is no end. Paul's assumption is that there is an end and it is imminent. And that is the crisis for the appropriation of the apocalyptic gospel. Bill?
So the real issue is the sovereignty of God.
Oh, well.
Our history goes on forever. You know, God is not sovereign.
Well, I hadn't ever thought of it that way, but that may be what it is. You know. It may be the another way to put it is that since our history is going on forever, we really don't need a new creation. Or to put it another way, since
just new and improved, right?
Huh?
Just new and improved
product. Well, what happens is that apocalyptic is dissolved into an imminent developmental philosophy of history. Every day and every way we're getting better. And so what happens is, when history contradicts that, then you have nothing to fall into but despair. Huh? See, when you have these great cataclysmic disasters, then the immanental view of history as containing within it its own meaning collapses, and the only thing that is left is despair, suicide. And closely related to this, I think, is then the irrelevance of the whole doctrine of resurrection. You see? Since everything is going to have its own meaning, then you don't really need a God who creates out of nothing and who gives meaning to that which is meaningless. The parousia is the time of the general resurrection. Right? Now, it is a bodily resurrection in the sense that Paul could not conceive of existence without some means of expression. And so the body is the means of expression of individual existence. And just as we have had this physical body as the means of our individual existence in this life, so in the age to come, we will be given a body. But it is not to be confused with the continuation of this physical body.
I was thinking that when I said body, I think the body of Christ in general. Cosmic, collective, universal.
Oh, yes, universal. Yes.
Okay, so when we look at Baker's study, then, this preoccupation that we have with death has to do with the fact that we do live in a time where we expect no end. And this has been something which has been created out of this feeling of insecurity or whatever it may be, that we are totally off base with our perspective.
So, and our conception of resurrection, instead of being resurrection, is immortality. That is some sort of continuation of what we are. That it's going to go on. You know? And since it's going to go on, you don't really need resurrection. Oh. Now, I don't think you can just simply adopt Paul's apocalyptic theology, you know. But I do think that you cannot do justice to Paul's theology without paying attention to its apocalyptic character in its entirety. And then you'll know what it is that you have rejected. And you'll know what it is that you have accepted. And it seems to me that that's the issue. Now, again, I think it's important to see that Paul's apostolic ministry is not something that he himself does. It is the preaching of Christ. It is rooted and grounded in that kind of theological understanding. So that this is not the imagining of an egomaniac, you know, but rather it is the faithfulness of a servant who has been called to a particular task in terms of a particular situation. You know, it is the way that Paul lives under the lordship of Christ. In other words, I don't think you can understand Paul's doctrine of justification as his Christian experience without seeing that his apostolic ministry is the living out of justification. That is, there is no such thing as justification which does not carry with it the empowerment for a task, empowerment for ministry. When we are justified, we are empowered. When we are graced, we are always claimed by grace for a particular function. That is the theological undergirding for every ministry in the church. Everything that is done in the church is the consequence of justification, the justification of the ungodly. Now, Paul is here laying down the basis for the inclusion of the Jews. And the basis for that is to understand that what is now given to Gentile Christians is not complete without including Israel. Now, again, why is that an issue? It has to do with this apocalyptic framework, again. Well, why is it a problem? The reason I'm pressing this, if these things do not become problems that you can identify, then it seems to me the exegesis is just sort of messing around. They're not dealing with anything that is real. Isn't that a fair question to ask you? Why is that a problem?
I believe it's a problem because God's intention is to redeem all creation.
Oh, exactly. So,
you can't let any of them get away.
Justice. Hey, yes. And you put back at the beginning then, Israel as the recipient of the promise, and the dialectical history of Israel, you see, is a history of receiving the promise and at the same time rejecting the promise. Now, what is at stake here is Israel as representative of the whole rebellious world. And so then, if you let Israel go, then what you have in this new age is not a witness to the new creation. What you have is a little Christian ghetto. And I think that's what we have. Pretty much reduced Paul's vision here to a sanctuary for the pious. What I'm trying to get you to do now is to see how that Paul's articulation of his apostolic ministry here at the end of chapter 10 is essential to understanding what he's going to develop in chapter 11. See, if God is the Lord of the whole earth, of the whole cosmos, then that lordship must include Israel. See, that is the logic of this. Yes.
Can I express what you said in another way?
Yeah.
Is it that the exegesis, for example, is important because we need to recognize and assume responsibility for our corporate.
Oh, yeah. For our. And it's not simply a matter of our individual responsibility. It is a matter of acknowledging God as God of the whole creation, you see. And so what you really have, I think inevitably, if you turn away from this, is the heresy of Martian. That is, you develop a God of the old covenant and a God of the new covenant. And Paul is saying there is one God. The God of creation is the God of redemption. And so any redemption that leaves out the wholeness of creation is simply inadequate. Now that is the apocalyptic vision. And that's the reason that this apocalyptic stuff is so important. However you retranslate it and work it into a modern worldview, it seems to me it is essential to recognize what was being said in the apocalyptic vision as not something that is around on the margins of Christian faith, but is already embedded at the heart of Christian faith. And so if you attempt, as has so often been done, to peel off and to get rid of the apocalyptic imagery, and then say we've got the true Paul, what you've done is to violate Paul, and you don't have anything left. No. No. I think what is at stake here again is an understanding of Paul's use of the category or the concept, the idea of predestination. Predestination doesn't have anything to do with modern theories of determinism and indeterminism. It has everything to do with the fact that the history of the world is qualified by God's action in the world. And God's action in the world is the presupposition of faith, as it is also the presupposition of unfaith. It is the presupposition of obedience, as it is also the presupposition of rebellion. Yeah.
if I understand what you're saying, then in the breaking in of the new age and the new creation on the old age, such as Paul says, the new age and the new creation is not something that we can objectively identify. But yet he's asking us to proclaim that it is here, and yet we can't proclaim objectively that it is here. I'm confused as to...
Well, I think that...
...to say that this is Christian here, you know, or that this is the new age breaking in, for fear it's worse.
Well, I think just as there is no... You take Israel as a type of the church. It seems to me that that's always what Paul is working with. But Israel as a type of the church has no continuity in its own history. See, the continuity of Israel is dependent solely and exclusively upon God's election. Now, if you follow that through, then you would say, as Paul will say, I think later on in chapter 11, that the continuity in the life of the church is not dependent upon any kind of imminent religiosity or virtue or power or whatever else you might think of in the history of the church. It is dependent exclusively upon the election of God. So that the church experiences in human history the same risk that Israel always experiences. Now, to even complicate this further, and we're jumping ahead, but Paul will talk about the remnant. Now, what is the historical expression of the remnant? It is Jewish Christianity. When you finally cut through everything, that's what it is. But the remnant is not meaningful except in relationship to the whole. The remnant is, at one and the same time, the judgment upon all of Israel, and at the same time, the ground of the hope which Paul has for all of Israel. Again, just to sort of summarize what I think is going on in verses 18 through 21, it is Paul's use of the Hebrew Scriptures in order to interpret the preaching of the gospel, his own apostolic ministry. He has reappropriated the tradition, and he has shaped the tradition under the control of his doctrine of the justification of the ungodly. Now, what has been revealed to the Gentiles, you know, when he says, I have shown myself to those who did not ask for me, he is talking specifically about a concrete eschatological activity. And what is that? It is nice that we're having a final examination in this court, because those are the kinds of questions that I'm going to ask you, dear children. That's a fair question, isn't it? What does that mean? I have shown myself to those who did not ask for me. I have been found by those who did not seek me. Now, do you remember how this started out? I bear them witness that they have a zeal for God, but it is not enlightened for being ignorant of the righteousness that comes from God and seeking to establish their own, they did not submit to God's righteousness. Now, what changes that situation?
Revelation?
Yeah, but I want you to use the Pauline word for that. What is it that Paul talks about then in verses 5 through 13? What is the theme of that whole section? What? Read the text. Well, but how does that take shape? Well, but what is the Pauline phrase for that? How does he talk about it? The word is near you. The word is near you. And it is that word, you see, that is the basis of the acceptance of the Gentiles, and it is the word that is the basis of the rejection of Israel. He's talking about Christian preaching. And he's talking about Christian preaching as eschatological event. Now, what you have then is Paul facing squarely in chapter 11 what seems to be the contradiction in the history of Israel of the apocalyptic vision. I ask then, and this again is in the language of the diatribe, I ask then, has God rejected his people? By no means. And then he's going to give the arguments that will support this ringing denial. By no means. See, he doesn't say, well, possibly. Paul hardly ever says, well, possibly. He hardly ever says, maybe. I ask then, has God rejected his people? By no means. I myself am an Israelite, a descendant of Abraham, a member of the tribe of Benjamin. God has not rejected his people whom he foreknew. Do you not know what the scripture says of Elijah, how he pleads with God against Israel? Lord, they have killed thy prophets, they have demolished thy altars, and I alone am left, and they seek my life. But what is God's reply to him? I have kept for myself 7,000 men who have not bowed the knee to Baal. So too, at the present time, there is a remnant chosen by grace. But if it is by grace, it is no longer on the basis of works. Otherwise, grace would no longer be grace. Now, the first thing that Paul does here to establish the by no means is his own experience as a Christian. See, Paul is a sign in his own life of what God intends for all of Israel. Now, what is Paul? This is strange, isn't it? I keep forgetting it, and I suspect you do too. We always think of Paul as a Gentile, don't we? Not so. Paul is a Jewish Christian. and he is a living sign of God's intent, not only God's intent, but of God's success in saving Israel. Now, Paul belongs to the remnant. And so that leads him to this, again, notice here how what Paul is doing, this is the reappropriation of the tradition of the Torah story in a new context. Do you not know what the scripture says of Elijah? How he pleads with God against Israel? Lord, they have killed thy prophets, they have demolished thy altars, and I alone am left, and they seek my life. And Paul here is identifying himself as a sign of the eschatological work of God with Elijah. And what he's doing here is acknowledging the fact that he himself is caught in that same kind of predicament. That is, the history seems to contradict the vision of the salvation of Israel, the fulfillment of the promises of God. Now what is it then that God says to him? I have kept for myself 7,000 men who have not bowed the knee to Baal. Now, the remnant is not self-contained. It is not meaningful in itself. It is related to the whole. And what is being articulated here is that what has been realized in the remnant is God's intent for all Israel. See, that's the basis of the argument. And it is not the case that the remnant is ever a remnant because of its fulfillment of righteousness. It is not the remnant because it is pious. It is a remnant simply because of grace. But if it is by grace, it is no longer on the basis of works. Otherwise, grace would no longer be grace. Now, here again, I think one must experience the difference between Paul's understanding of the remnant and the understanding of the remnant that was current in Rabbinic Judaism. The understanding of the remnant in Rabbinic Judaism, as we can recover that in the documents from Qumran, is that the remnant is characterized by radical obedience to the law. No. Paul says, what characterizes and qualifies the remnant is grace, justification of the ungodly. And that is God's work. If there is a remnant in human history, then it is there solely as a reminder of God's invincible grace. And it is a reminder that God's grace includes all of Israel. What then? Israel failed to obtain what it sought. The elect obtained it, but the rest were hardened, as it is written. God gave them a spirit of stupor, eyes that should not see and ears that should not hear down to this very day. And David says, let their feast become a snare and a trap, a pitfall and a retribution for them. Let their eyes be darkened so that they cannot see, and bend their backs forever. Now, again, it seems to me that verses 7 through 10 are an exegesis of, an explication of, an interpretation of verses 2 and 3. I bear them witness, that they have a zeal for God, but it is not enlightened. For being ignorant of the righteousness that comes from God and seeking to establish their own, they did not submit to God's righteousness. Now, one of the things that I think Paul is doing is appropriating the history of Israel as a representative history. It is not simply a history of Israel as over against the Gentiles. It is a history of the human family in its totality. Now, that's another thing, it seems to me, that's important for us to keep in mind. And it's one of the reasons that the interpretation of this material is so slippery. Now, and particularly, Israel is an example of the corruption, the cosmic bondage, the demonic possession of the pious. It is precisely at the point of religious expression and religious success that the sovereignty of God is violated. And it is violated by a profound dislocation in the human situation. It is the case that the pious are a denial not only of God, but of humanity. Do you see this? See, he's not how comforting it would be if you could read this as Paul's indictment of sins. Then you know, you go on your merry way, attacking all the sinners. And you know who they are, don't you? They're the people who do the things that I no longer want to do or am too tired to do if I wanted to do them. He's talking about the cult. He's talking about the sacrifices. He's talking about the rules and regulations. He's talking about the whole trappings, the whole machinery, the technology of standing in the presence of God on the basis of one's merit. And the better that is, the more dangerous it is. That's the point, it seems to me. He's not speaking generally. He is attacking the problem at its basic and fundamental root. That is, living under another sovereignty. Living under a sovereignty that is ours. That's it. See? Living under a righteousness that is ours. And Israel is representative of those who are hardened by their response to God, who all day long holds out God's hands to a disobedient and contrary people. And again, Paul is talking about the law as the basis of this kind of religious orientation. It is the law that has been perverted, law which is no longer a sign of God's promise, but is now a sign of those who labor to achieve their own righteousness. It is laborious. Laboring to bring off that which is impossible. And that's the reason it is such a sad pursuit. There is no joy in it even when it seems to be happy. You're always looking around. Huh? You can tell how this works. You're looking around and saying, are we having fun? If you have to ask, you aren't.
Amen.
Got to create some kind of atmosphere of merriment, you see. And I think that's involved here. She, notice the language. The language assaults the cult at its heart. Let their feast become a snare and a trap. Well, there is a warning there, it seems to me, about the demonic dimension of worship. And again, let their eyes be darkened so they cannot see. You see, it is an illusion. And the illusion results in drudgery, notice, and bend their backs forever. You know, the terrible thing about it is that it is going nowhere. And it is going nowhere. Heavily burdened. Now, Paul is here being realistic, and I have no doubt in my mind that he is recalling his own pre-Christian experience and appropriating it. So I ask, have they stumbled so as to fall? That doesn't mean what it seems to say. Of course they have stumbled, and they have fallen. But he means, have they fallen irretrievably? Is it a final fall? Is their fall the end of the story? Is it? Huh? And notice again, this eschatological, by no means, you see. When Paul makes these statements, he is not making these statements on the basis of an inner conviction. It's not because he is a sincere person. It is because he lives in submission to the gospel. And in submission to the gospel, he cannot live in despair. See, that by no means is the joy of the apostle. But I never thought about that that way, but that might be a good way to do this whole thing, you know. By no means, you know. By no means. And that means what it says. By no means. The reversal is by no means. It is by no trick of our own. You see, it is exclusively and unconditionally, irrevocably God's work. But through their trespass, salvation has come to the Gentiles so as to make Israel jealous. That God is using the rebellion of Israel in the same way that God uses the rebellion of the Pharaoh. And the end is salvation. Now, if their trespass means riches for the world, and if their failure means riches for the Gentiles, how much more will their full inclusion mean? And again, these things that we just sort of pass over as of no consequence, I think, are the clue to the Pauline argument. How much more? And notice how often how much more crops up in the argument. How much more is eschatological? How much more doesn't have anything to do with some optimistic view of human history. If there's any person in the world who ever had a pessimistic view of human history, it is Paul. He is a pessimist, unrelieved about the human condition. And you cannot avoid that conclusion if you have understood what he has written about the best that human history could produce according to his own judgment. The best that human history could produce is the cult of Israel. And Paul says, how much more? Now, what he's talking about here is the dialectical relationship between Jew and Gentile. At one level, the Jew-Gentile division is wiped out by the gospel. See? At another level, the Jew-Gentile division is appropriated by the gospel as a way of talking about the salvation of the world, so that the Gentile is not complete in Gentile salvation without the Jew, and the Jew cannot stand in the presence of God without the Gentile. And again, in apocalyptic, the apocalyptic vision, Jew, Gentile means the whole cosmos. Now, that's what he's really working with here. Oh, riches. Paul is talking about grace. The full expression of God's power. No. The life of the Gentile under the sovereignty of God is not complete so long as Israel is not under the sovereignty of God. Just as in the salvation history promises that are given in the Hebrew Scriptures, the life of Israel under the sovereignty of God is always incomplete until the Gentiles are brought in. Now I'm speaking to you Gentiles. Inasmuch then as I am an apostle to the Gentiles, I magnify my ministry in order to make my fellow Jews jealous and thus save some of them. Now, for if their rejection means the reconciliation of the world, what will their acceptance mean but life from the dead? If the dough offered as first fruits is holy, so is the whole lump, and if the root is holy, so are the branches. Now, what he's done here is to say that you cannot understand Paul as an apostle to the Gentiles except as you see that as implying apostleship to the Jews. Well, directly, he is sent by God to the Gentiles. But indirectly, whatever he does for the Gentiles is in order to the inclusion of the Jews. And that's what it means to say here, I magnify my ministry. And he sees his eschatological mission as moving the Jews toward conversion. But believe me, that conversion is an eschatological event. Now, again, this whole business about the part representing the whole is at stake in the metaphors at the end of the section. If the dough offered as first fruits is holy, so is the whole lump. That is, you cannot separate the part from God's intent for the whole. And that's what is going on with this root. And holiness has to do with God's action. It is God that makes holy. And God intends to sanctify the whole creation. And that has to do with God's claim upon the whole creation. God will be God. And God can't be God. Now, this is really what's at stake. It is basically and fundamentally not a problem in theodicy. It is a problem about theology, basically. In itself, there can be no God for Paul unless God is God for the whole creation. See that? Huh? Now that's a problem with excluding anybody. See? The problem with excluding anybody is that it is practical atheism. Giving up. Huh? So all this sitting around and wringing our hands, you know, and groveling in our failures is what? Atheism. It's a denial of God. Now, Paul wants to relate this whole business. It may be that in verses 17 through 24, you have the clue to why he writes the letter. Why he writes the letter. And I think that the more I think about this, the more I'm convinced that he writes the letter because he believes that the majority, that is, the Gentile Christians, are about to fall back into the fate of Israel. Well, that's so simple, it can't be true. But let's read through the section and then see if that is not the case. But if some of the branches were broken off and you, a wild olive shoot, were grafted in their place to share the richness of the olive tree, do not boast over the branches. If you do boast, remember it is not you that support the root, but the root that supports you. You will say, branches were broken off so that I might be grafted in. That is true. They were broken off because of their unbelief, but you stand fast only through faith. So do not become proud, but stand in awe. For if God did not spare the natural branches, neither will he spare you. Note then the kindness and the severity of God. Severity toward those who have fallen, but God's kindness to you, provided you continue in his kindness. Otherwise, you too will be cut off. and even the others, if they do not persist in their unbelief, will be grafted in, for God has the power to graft them in again. For if you have been cut from what is by nature a wild olive tree and grafted contrary to nature into a cultivated olive tree, how much more will these natural branches be grafted back into their own olive tree? How much more? Huh? Now you see what's at stake, don't you? See, what is at stake is boasting. And notice here, Paul, you can almost see Paul's mind working. You can almost see him say, don't boast. And then he says, boast. Because he knows, as we have already discovered, that boasting is the human condition. See? And it is not the case that you get rid of being human. You see? That's not what Paul is ever about. Paul is saying that Christianity, living in the righteousness of God, is living as a human. Now, living in the righteousness of the law is living in denial of one's humanity. Faith is not a possession. See? And again, it seems to me that that's always lurking there as a trap. To become secure in one's faith is to deny what faith is. You boast in what you cannot do. Which is a strange kind of boasting, isn't it? It is a paradoxical boasting. To boast in what you cannot do is, in fact, not to boast. If you do boast, remember it is not you that support the root, but the root that supports you. You will say, branches were broken off so that I might be grafted in. That is true. They were broken off because of their unbelief. But you stand fast only through faith. So do not become proud, but stand in awe. I think that the paradoxical nature of this is obscured by the translation awe. It probably is better to say stand in fear. Now, you begin to see the paradoxical nature of Christian experience at this point. Let me just sort of talk about that for a moment. That is, when Christian freedom is perverted, you see, and becomes then freedom to live on the basis of one's own autonomy, it is then a denial of fearlessness in relationship to the world, and becomes once again, in the name of Christian liberty, bondage to the cosmos. The only way to stand freed from fear of the cosmos is to stand in the fear of God. Now, that is, again, the paradoxical nature of Christian freedom that comes out here in this section. And why is Paul doing that? Why does he find it necessary to begin to address directly Gentile Christians, where faith is always at risk? Faith is not a possession. It is always the work of the Word and must be received always as a gift. why is this an alien righteousness? That's a good word. It is strange. It is the righteousness of another. And it is the righteousness of a Lord who is always another, who always addresses, you know, this is the reason that word business is so important, always addresses us, speaks to us what we didn't really want to hear. I think that gratitude is a little bit less confrontive than fear, but it seems to me that gratitude is an authentic mark of standing in the presence of God so long as we know the focus of gratitude. When I began to be grateful, I began to reveal what kind of righteousness I live in. And it is not an alien righteousness, it is a domesticated righteousness. I am grateful for these things that I have that distinguish me from you poor turkeys. Huh? But gratitude is basically and fundamentally a focusing of one's life in the Lord. Huh? What Paul is doing then, I think, is reminding the Gentiles of how they stand in the presence of God. They stand always in the presence of God by the righteousness of God, by the power of God. And God's power that has given them standing is God's power that will give the Jews standing. That's the logic of it. There is no salvation for the Gentile that is not also the salvation that Paul proclaims for Israel. See, there is nothing in the Gentile Christian experience that is different from the salvation that is promised to Israel. Doesn't he say at the end of this? Huh? What? How much more will these natural branches be grafted back into their own olive tree? Of whom is he speaking? Those who have been cut off. Now, you see again, the dialectical interpretation here of cut off. You cannot be grafted in except as you're cut off. Huh? See, what the Gentiles in their natural condition are illustrative of what? Cut off! See? How did they get in? Because they had a predisposition toward the gospel? That's romantic nonsense, you know. See? They got in because of God's grace. They're being cut off, as Paul described it in the first chapter, is judgment. And I think Paul would say, I think he does say, that judgment is the way that we appropriate God's grace. I mean that only those who are judged have any opportunity for salvation. Rejoice in your judgment.
And is that judgment experienced in the context of that risk involved with faith?
That every time You stand in the presence of the Word. You stand in judgment. The Word in Paul is a dialectical word. It can't just be reduced to a word that confirms us in what we are. Huh? Well, let me read this next section, because the next section is the last and final articulation of the doctrine of justification by faith in the book of Romans. Lest you be wise in your own conceits, I want you to understand this mystery, brethren. A hardening has come upon part of Israel until the full number of the Gentiles come in. And so all Israel will be saved. As it is written, the deliverer will come from Zion. He will banish ungodliness from Jacob. And this will be my covenant with them when I take away their sins. As regards the gospel, they are enemies of God for your sake. But as regards election, they are beloved for the sake of their forefathers. For the gifts and the call of God are irrevocable. Just as you were once disobedient to God, but now have received mercy because of their disobedience, so now they have been disobedient in order that by the mercy shown to you, they also may receive mercy. For God has consigned all men to disobedience, that he may have mercy upon all. You see, if there are any in Rome who claim to be disobedient, they have already slipped and fallen, and they are recipients of the wrath of God. So much for the Romans. What is Paul working with here? Well, I think he is saying that Israel is a type of the gospel. Yeah. What is the presupposition of the disobedience? God. God's election. God's claim. He's talking about the reality of human existence. He's not talking about what if. He is interpreting his history. I think it's important for us to see that, and not to get off onto this speculation business. And he is drawing out the consequences of the word that is the presupposition of his own Christian experience. He is drawing out the consequences of that Christian experience or his interpretation of God's dealing with Israel. He is drawing out the consequences of that experience for God's dealing with the whole creation. But he does not begin with some speculative theory. He begins with his Christian experience. I think he begins with the forgiveness of sins. If you want to just reduce it to what it is.
All persons, as well as the universe, will be saved.
So, he's saying the opposite. He's saying you don't get to all by way of individuals. It's the other way around. All is the presupposition of individual existence. It's not the matter of bringing in one by one and finally getting to all, but rather it is the fact that God's salvation includes all, and that is the presupposition of any kind of individuality. That's like the Holy Catholic Church. You see, you don't get to the Holy Catholic Church by bring them in one by one. No, you begin with the Holy Catholic Church. That is the start. And the individual has his or her security and individuality and existence in relationship to the whole. All Israel. Oh, let me say something else here then before we break. That I think that we need to recall. One of my ambitions sometime, I maybe like most of my ambitions, going to be frustrated and have reality only in terms of the apocalyptic vision. But one of my ambitions is to teach the Gospel of Mark and Romans together, you see, and to take the doctrine of justification by faith and show how that is incarnate in the Markan narratives. And let me give you an example here that Caseman has pointed out. But I think you can do it with any market narrative. See, what really is at stake in this last statement about the justification of the ungodly is what Jesus says in the second chapter of Mark in the 17th verse in response to those who ask, why does he eat with sinners? Huh? And the answer is, I came not to call the righteous, but the ungodly, sinners. For those who are well have no need of a physician, but those who are sick. Now, you know that in the Markan narrative, what that means is that there's only one group, and it is an all-inclusive group. That is the reality that is revealed in the gospel. You see? In the reality of the gospel, you see the human condition. What is the word for it?
Ungodly.
Sinners, ungodly, sick. Huh? That's all. Now, what is at stake here? Notice how the section begins. Lest you be wise in your own conceits. I want you to understand this mystery, brethren. Now, that is the wisdom of our own conceits, is illusion about ourselves. You see, it is in fact a conceit to think that you stand in the presence of God on the basis of any merit. The gospel shatters that illusion. Now then, how is that articulated in this verse? I want you to understand this mystery, brethren. What is the mystery? The fact that we stand before God, what is the other side of that? Huh? Oh, the mystery is the parousia. The mystery is the event of the coming of the exalted Lord. And the exalted Lord comes for one purpose and one purpose alone, and that is to announce forgiveness. The Gentiles do not come to Zion. In Paul's apocalyptic, that has been wiped out. It is the exalted Lord who comes from the new Jerusalem, and he comes to announce forgiveness of sins to all. See? Now, what is it that prevents one from hearing that now? Huh? Deceit. And nothing but deceit. Now, what happens in the parousia is not something that is added to. It is simply the inclusion of all in the salvation that is already experienced in the church as a sign of the new creation. That is, the forgiveness of sins. The judge, in the end, is the crucified. And there is then a kind of logical inevitability about Paul's pursuing the gospel in relationship to the Roman church, in relationship to the Jews, and in relationship to the whole creation. And this is the climax of the book, really.